a pair of glasses last time, but actually, if you learn a little bit about church history, it's a way of finding spectacles, in the sense that it gives you perspective to what is happening in the present day. And you won't understand a great deal of what is happening in the present day unless you learn something about the past. That is a very important principle which a lot of people are not observing today. So, thinking about William Grimshaw, who lived 250 years ago, is not a pointless exercise by any means. I hope some of you people read. There are books through there, and there will be books on William Grimshaw. There's one my wife has written, and it's available in hardback and paperback at some reduction. I know you all like bargains. Well, on the bookstore there's these bargains. And there's another slim one with lots of pictures. Now, some of you like pictures. There's lots of pictures in one called Heavenly Fire. I think that's a phrase from, what was his name? Hughes, Ted Hughes, who wasn't a Christian, but he knew a lot about Grimshaw. And he had a great admiration for Grimshaw, you'll be interested to know. And in this little book, Heavenly Fire, for about $3.95, you have a survey of the life of Grimshaw. I've entitled the lecture, William Grimshaw, Evangelist of the North. You know what they say about the Midlands? You are too far south to be north, and too far north to be south. But the north is an area about which people know less than they ought. Now, most great preachers have also been great characters. And sometimes they're more remembered for their eccentricities than for their spiritual ministry. That is very true of a man like Rowland Hill. Perhaps you haven't heard of Rowland Hill. Or if you've heard of Rowland Hill, you'll have only heard of some of his eccentricities. Yet he was a very great preacher who did a mighty work in London and founded the Surrey Chapel. At the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. And to some extent, this has also been true of William Grimshaw. He wasn't really a man of eccentricity, but he was a character, a big character. He was the rugged, perpetual curate. That was his official title. There was no vicar in residence in Haworth. He was the rugged, perpetual curate, as he was called, of Haworth, a town situated in the bleak Pennine uplands of West Yorkshire, 4 miles south of Keighley. Now, I'm wondering this evening how many of you have been to Haworth. Would you put your hands up, those who have? Oh, quite a few. Yes, you probably didn't go there to tread the Grimshaw Trail. You probably went there to tread the Bronte Trail, and about 200,000 people a year go to Haworth because of the Bronte sisters and their literary output. But if Grimshaw hadn't gone to Haworth, Patrick Bronte would never have gone to Haworth, because it was Grimshaw who established an evangelical tradition, and Patrick Bronte was an evangelical. And he wouldn't have gone to Haworth apart from Grimshaw. And therefore, if Grimshaw hadn't been in Haworth, there'd be no Wuthering Heights written, or any of these other novels that some of you read. So you can see that all these things tie in together. That's the importance of history, you see. Mrs. Gaskell, some of you will have heard the name Mrs. Gaskell, probably not read of any of her novels. It was Mrs. Gaskell and not Grimshaw who is responsible for the story that Grimshaw horsewhipped people from the adjoining public houses, the public houses adjoining the parish church, into the parish church on the Lord's Day in order to preach to them. You've probably heard that story. Well, it actually originated with Mrs. Gaskell. It wasn't Grimshaw who actually did that. I'll explain that later. Now, Grimshaw was a far greater man than Patrick Bronte. And Patrick Bronte succeeded him 80 years later in Haworth. And though Grimshaw did a far greater work than the Bronte sisters, as I think you will agree by the time I finish tonight, yet the world has largely forgotten Mad Grimshaw of Haworth, as some of the locals dubbed him, and only remember with revolting commercialism. You will agree with me, I think, if you've been to Haworth, revolting commercialism, the achievements of those notable literary ladies. But one who hadn't forgotten Grimshaw was this poet laureate, as he was before he died, Ted Hughes. And Ted Hughes said this: "To judge by the shock waves which could still be felt, I think, well into this century, William Grimshaw struck the whole region like a planet," he wrote in his notes to his poetry collection Remains of Elmer, published in 1979. And Ted Hughes was brought up in the neighbouring Heptonstall. And Heptonstall, from a sort of aesthetic point of view, is a much better place to visit than Haworth. Because if you go to Heptonstall, just south of Haworth, not far from Hebden Bridge, you will feel almost as though you're stepping back into the 18th century. You still have the cobblestones there. It's not an easy place to get to. It's certainly worth going to Heptonstall, and that's where Ted Hughes was brought up for a time. He writes, "To a degree, Grimshaw changed the very landscape. His heavenly fire, straight out of Blake's prophetic books, shattered the terrain into biblical landmarks. Quarries burst open like craters, and chapels, the bedrock transfigured, materialized, standing in them. Gradually it dawned on me," he concludes, "that I was living among the survivors, in the remains." Now that's a moving tribute, isn't it, by a man who wasn't even a Christian, but had a sense of Grimshaw's greatness. But very few Christians today know that William Grimshaw was the outstanding pioneer of the evangelical revival in the north of England, with perhaps the exception of the Wesley brothers in the Newcastle area, who did a mighty work there. And of course we mustn't forget the significant labours of men like Benjamin Ingham and John Nelson in evangelising Yorkshire, nor the effect of the occasional visits, which had a profound effect, of George Whitfield and John and Charles Wesley to Yorkshire. But William Grimshaw, with his burly frame and powerful voice, did more to spread the gospel in the north of England in the 18th century, I think one could say, than any other man. He rarely preached, wait for it, and anyone who's a preacher here tonight is going to get a shock, he rarely preached less than 20 times a week. And sometimes he preached as many as 30 times. But for the relief of any preachers here, may I say he didn't actually prepare 20 or 30 new sermons. But of course he repeated sermons, good sermons that he preached in other places, as he went from hamlet to hamlet and sometimes to farmhouse and then to town. He preached often four times and five times a day. Now, if there are any Yorkshiremen here, or Yorkshire women, I'm sorry to have to inform you and to disappoint you with the information that William Grimshaw was a Lancastrian. He was born in 1708 in a little sleepy village called Brindle. It was sleepy then, and it was sleepy when I visited it, so still sleepy today, between Blackburn and Chorley. His first recollections of spiritual impressions date from his early childhood, but neither his father, who was a church warden, nor his mother, appear to have any vital spiritual life at that time. I think his father was converted later in life. His mother was an opponent of the gospel, I think, to her dying day. He was admitted to Christ's College, Cambridge, in April 1726 at the early, but not in those days, unusual age of 17. They did their A-levels, so to speak, in the universities and not in their schools, so they went to university early. For the first 2 years, he tells us that he was sober and diligent as a student, but in the third year, to quote his own words, "falling in with bad company, I learned to drink, swear, and whatnot." But that was no obstacle to ordination, alas, either then or now, one has to say. In 1731, he became curate in charge of Littleborough near Rochdale, where his heavy drinking and worldly way of life continued. After 6 months, he moved on to Todmorden, midway between Bacup in Lancashire and Hebden Bridge in Yorkshire. A contemporary historian tells us that inhabitants of the district between Todmorden and Halifax at that time were, quote, "wild, uncouth, and as rugged as their native hills." And apparently no traveller could safely pass that way in assured safety. And Daniel Defoe informs us that the barbarity of the behaviour of the people was only to be matched by the barbarity of the punishment that was often meted out upon transgressors. Such local barbarity gave rise, in Defoe's opinion, to the proverbial saying, "From hell, Hull, and Halifax, good Lord, deliver us." You probably know that saying. Why Hull was included, and that's where my last ministry was, why Hull was included, Daniel Defoe could not determine. He could determine why Halifax was included. The 23-year-old Grimshaw was little better than the average inhabitant at that time. His main interests were fishing, card playing, and hunting, and his pastoral visits were usually given over to heavy drinking and merrymaking. But all this was soon to change. During this time, Grimshaw was not without pangs of conscience and longings to be a better man. How true that often is. He had suffered periods of remorse and self-reproach, and he had fought against temptation and sin, but it was a losing battle. He had sought to improve moral standards within his parish, but failing to preach the gospel, he had resorted to some bizarre methods. For example, a young man in the parish had made a girl pregnant, but refused to do what was regarded as the right and proper thing in those days by marrying her. Instead, he was arrogant about his sin and flippant in his attitude. And Grimshaw determined to teach him a lesson. He dressed up. He loved dressing up. All his life he was given to dressing up. Well, he dressed up, Grimshaw dressed up as the devil. Now, you've got to remember the people of those days that had vivid imaginations as to what the devil looked like. And Grimshaw was quite happy to assist those imaginations. He put on dark clothing and, you know, a tail. What he did was this: he concealed himself near a stile over which this young man would climb on his way home from work as dusk fell. And sure enough, this man came along, this young lad, and up over the stile, and as he was coming over the stile, rising up from the shadows with terrifying appearance, rose Grimshaw, dressed like the devil. And he grasped this man with an iron grip. And he said he would take him back to Hades with him unless he mended his ways and married this girl. Well, the young man was scared out of his wits. And he solemnly promised to put matters right. One day in 1734, Grimshaw was asked to help a young married couple whose baby had died suddenly, an early case of what today we call cot death. Now, this was the advice he gave them, to put away all gloomy thoughts and to get into merry company and divert yourselves and all will soon be right. Sounds a bit like modern psychotherapy, doesn't it? Well, it failed. And again, Grimshaw was sent for. But he had to confess to the parents that he was helpless to advise them because he was in as desperate a condition as they were. He was very honest and frank. And this experience of his own spiritual inadequacy shook him so much that from that time onwards a new seriousness entered into his life and he began to seek the Lord. This period of conviction was later to be described by him in the following words, describing a typical sinner. He has looked into the bottomless pit, has seen his own offences tormented in others and their brands shaken at him. He has seen the devil's face, both as a tempter and a tormentor. He has heard the clamour of conscience and been therewith so disquieted as not to rest till he betake himself to God, with whom he at first meets with rigour, but soon after with mercy and compassion. At this time, however, Grimshaw himself had not obtained mercy, and his awakening was mainly moral in character. He began, for example, to warn his parishioners of their spiritual danger, and he himself became much more diligent in his pastoral duties. But his own only message was to urge upon his hearers the need of a strict and upright life. "My friends," he cried out in despair in the middle of one of his services, "we are in a damnable state, and I scarcely know how we are to get out of it." And the time of his release had not yet arrived. But what did arrive, and this diverted him from his spiritual concerns, was a dashing young widow by the name of Sarah Sutcliffe, who had had him clearly in her sights. And with breathtaking initiative and audacity, she rode past his lodgings one day on her horse, calling out to him, "I am come to bid a penny at you," which in those days apparently was the way of proposing marriage. And like many another unsuspecting young man in similar circumstances, he fell for her and married this well-to-do heiress soon afterwards. A son, John, was born 10 months later in April 1736. And then in the following year, a daughter, Jane. Throughout this period, the outward forms of moral and religious reformation in his life had been maintained, but his inner spiritual interest had subsided. His wife was little help to him spiritually, though he loved her very dearly. But God had not let him go. He experienced another spiritual awakening in 1738, when he began to apply himself with much diligence to regular prayer, self-examination and religious duties. And he kept a large folio ledger. This is an amazing thing. He kept this large folio ledger, which had a debit and credit side. And one who knew him wrote these words: "He was for 7 years, as he informed me himself, earnestly working out a righteousness of his own. In a large folio, he daily set down his sins on one page and his good works on the other, and kept his accounts of debtor and creditor as regularly as any merchant. In whatever he imagined he had sinned, he did as many good works as he supposed would atone for his offences, and then, crossing his book, thought he kept an even account with God. He had this weekly, monthly, and annual fasts, and made a point of having all even at the year's end, and in this method he proceeded for 7 years. Very sad, isn't it, to think of how he proceeded in that fashion. Any auditor, spiritual auditor, well, God is the great spiritual auditor, isn't he? He would have declared him bankrupt in no time, but in this way he proceeded. And it reminds you of the members of the Holy Club in Oxford, to which earlier George Whitfield and the Wesleys, Benjamin Ingham, William Morgan and others belonged, who sought to secure their salvation in a very similar manner through their own righteousness. And so here we see Grimshaw with frequent fastings engaging in the same fruitless pursuit of trying to work out his own salvation by his own righteousness. He knew that he was not right with God, but although there had been a reformation of life and a new seriousness had entered into his partial work, yet he was still in bondage of soul, knowing nothing of real peace or of justifying righteousness from a forgiving God through Jesus Christ. In November 1738, William Grimshaw's wife died, leaving him with the two small children and in great desolation of spirit. His wife's family took the children, but he was left alone in the house, close to despair. He experienced, in consequence, I think, a terrible time of fierce temptation and spiritual conflict, when every holy thing was threatened by blasphemous thoughts and fearful doubt. Satan was sifting him, but God was bringing him to an end of himself. A traveling preacher had frequently rebuked Grimshaw for his legalistic view of salvation. I'd love to know who that preacher was, because there were very few preachers of the gospel in those days. But this man was a traveling preacher. He traveled through Howard from time to time, and he said to Grimshaw, "Mr. Grimshaw, you are a Jew. You are no believer in Jesus Christ. You are building on the sand." He called him a Jew because he was trying to work out his own salvation through good works. And those words kept echoing in Grimshaw's mind. "You are building on the sand." And then one day, early in 1742, and this was a remarkable account, he was in the house of a friend, and there he picked up a book, just casually picked up a book, and as he picked up the book, a flash of heat struck him on the face. And he opened the book and looked at the title page, and he discovered it was by Dr. John Owen on justification by faith. And as he opened the book, another flash of heat came upon him. The title page read, "The Doctrine of Justification by Faith Through the Imputed Righteousness of Christ Explained, Confirmed, and Vindicated." And I think we should add, as only John Owen could do it. Within the book, Owen outlined his purpose, quote, "to inquire diligently into the divine revelation of the way whereby the conscience of a distressed sinner may attain assured peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ." Here at last was help for the poor, tormented soul of William Grimshaw. He borrowed the book and he read it carefully. Incidentally, his view of the flash of heat on his face twice, he took to be a sign, a God-given, heaven-sent sign, that there was something in that book that he especially had to read. Now, I believe God sometimes does give signs like that. Today, if we're not careful, we put God into a straitjacket, which he doesn't inhabit for himself. And these strange happenings are sometimes indeed God-given. A friend of Philip Doddridge, James Gardiner, Colonel James Gardiner, he had a very similar experience. Well, Grimshaw borrowed the book, and the result was as follows, as he described it. "I was now willing," he said, "to renounce myself, every degree of fancied merit and ability, and to embrace Christ only for my all in all. Oh, what light and comfort did I now enjoy in my own soul, and what a taste of the pardoning love of God." So his 7 years of seeking and searching and bondage were at an end. Well, the joys of salvation were reflected immediately, of course, in Grimshaw's preaching. His emphasis now fell not upon sort of moralism and moralistic emphases. His emphasis fell upon salvation by faith alone through the imputed righteousness of Jesus Christ, no longer upon the works of man's works of righteousness. Some who heard him accused him of preaching a novel doctrine. "What's this?" they said. But he demonstrated from the 39 Articles of the Church of England and from the from other documents that this was not so. Some success followed his preaching at Todmorden, and this was later to become one of the early Methodist strongholds. But Grimshaw had married again, and about six months before his conversion, and he and his wife were soon to move to Haworth, where he became what was called the perpetual curate in charge. His new wife was Elizabeth, and she brought up the two children he had had by his former wife. But sadly, after 5 years, she fell sick with a fever and died. And he didn't know what to do, whether to remarry. I think unquestionably he should have remarried, but he took a Spanish guilder, gold guilder, I think that's what they call them, and he tossed up this guilder to cast lots to see whether he should get married again. And it came down in the negative. And then he thought, well, you know, am I doing right casting lots to determine this matter? So he said to himself, well, I know I'm a Christian, and therefore I'll top up the guilder, am I a Christian or not? And it came down and it said yes. So therefore he thought he ought to obey it in the first instance, and he never married again. Sad. Well, Grimshaw no sooner settled in Haworth in 1742, when the beginnings of a remarkable revival appeared. The events which took place in that year, and particularly from 1744 onwards, and throughout the 21 years of his ministry there, were remarkable, and made him the acknowledged leader of the evangelical revival in the north of England. The spread of the gospel throughout the north of England was without question one of the great consequences of the evangelical revival. From the mid-1730s onwards, revival had been breaking out spontaneously in various parts of Europe and America. In London and Bristol, people had been aroused by the preaching of George Whitfield and John Wesley. And Hal Harris had established numerous preaching centres in Wales, and he was soon to be joined by that remarkable preacher, Daniel Rowland. Spiritual awakening had affected the Highlands of Scotland in 1739, and in 1742 a mighty work took place in Cambuslang and Kilsyth. The north of England felt the first effects of this evangelical awakening, as we refer to it, in 1738, when Benjamin Ingham, born at Osset and a former member of the Holy Club in Oxford, returned from Georgia, where he'd gone with the Wesleys as a missionary. He returned to his home area and he began a significant work throughout the area of Wakefield, Osset, Leeds and Halifax. And John Nelson, a great man was John Nelson, converted under John Wesley in London, but a native of Birstall, in the West Riding was soon to join Ingham in the work. And these two men, Ingham and Nelson, were instrumental in establishing over 50 religious societies in a very short period of time in the West Riding of Yorkshire and Lancashire. Grimshaw, in an account of the revival which he wrote in 1754, speaks of a great ingathering of souls through the work of those two men, John Nelson and Benjamin Ingham. But in 1742, whilst their work was going on, Grimshaw was only vaguely aware of what was happening, except that he was able to write, "In this year, our dear Lord was pleased to visit my parish." And we see, therefore, that the revival in Haworth in 1742 was a local manifestation of a far greater work of God that was affecting most of the British Isles and also parts of Europe and the New World in America. But the repercussions of the Haworth revival were to extend into all the adjoining counties. Now, those of you who put up your hands and said you'd visited Haworth, you'd have been much more interested in your visit, wouldn't you, if you'd known all this. So you'll have to go again. The revival in Haworth broke out almost as soon as Grimshaw began to preach there. The town at that time was one of the most important centres for the Worcester clothing industry, with much of the work being done in the local homes. The people were tough, very tough. They're still tough. They were even tougher in those days. They were of an independent character and had few human graces. Now, this rugged, straight-speaking, no-nonsense Grimshaw appealed to them. His dedication and burning zeal for their eternal interests soon deeply affected them, and the handful of worshippers on his arrival quickly became overflowing congregations. Grimshaw describes the beginning of the revival as follows. "In 1742, our dear Lord was pleased to visit my parish. A few souls were affected under the word, brought to see their lost estate by nature and to experience peace through faith in the blood of Jesus. My church began to be crowded, insomuch that many were obliged to stand out of doors. Here, as in other places, it was amazing to hear and see what weeping and roaring and agonies many people were seized with at the apprehension of their sinful state and the wrath of God. The church building held about 1,000 hearers, but soon many could only find room in the churchyard. And people flocked from other parishes to listen to the preacher who told them how their sins could be forgiven. Grimshaw frequently preached to overflowing crowds of men and women standing patiently in the churchyard and often in biting winds which swept down from the Pennines and still do. When Whitfield and the Wesleys later preached there, the extensive graveyard," and those of you who've been there and been in the parish church will know how extensive the graveyard is. I think it was probably even bigger in Grimshaw's day. "Well, that graveyard was thronged with people, numbering upward, particularly when Whitfield came, and the Wesleys, of 6,000 people would stand in that graveyard listening to the preaching." And I've got a note here of an incident that happened when Whitfield came to preach. What happened was that Grimshaw built an outside pulpit on some sort of scaffolding at the side of the church, and the preacher had to go in the church and climb up a ladder and go out of the window onto this scaffolding where he could see all the people gathered in the graveyard. And in August, this is jumping ahead a few years, in August 1756, Whitfield preached there on that scaffolding pulpit, and he announced his text: "It is appointed unto men once to die, and after this the judgment." And he announced his text as only George Whitfield could. And just after announcing his text, there was a wild, terrifying shriek from amongst the people. And some sort of disturbance, and Grimshaw hurried to the spot and returned through the crowd, pushing his way through the crowd to Whitfield, and cried out to Whitfield, "Brother Whitfield, you stand among the dead and the living. An immortal soul has just been called into eternity. The destroying angel is passing over the congregation. Cry aloud and spare not." The occurrence was announced, or what had happened was announced to the people, and after a few moments, Whitfield again announced his text. "It is appointed unto men once to die, and after this, the judgment." And again, a loud, piercing shriek came from the very spot, or near the very spot, where the Countess of Huntingdon and Lady Margaret Ingham were standing. And a thrill of horror, of course, went right through the gathered thousands. And they learnt that a second person had fallen dead, victim to the King of Terrors. Well, of course, this disturbed the whole gathering, but after a time, Whitfield indicated that he would proceed with his sermon. And you can imagine the hush that came upon the people as he announced again his text. "It is appointed unto men once to die, but after this, the judgment," which was followed with eloquent warnings that sinners should flee from the wrath to come and seek mercy through Jesus Christ. Such were those days of revival there in Haworth. The physical manifestations associated with the revival Grimshaw tended to discourage. The roarings, the convulsions that sometimes took place, the agonies could easily, he perceived, become part of the devil's work if care was not exercised in order to discredit the true work of God. What Grimshaw sought was conviction of sin in amongst the people, and the power of Jesus Christ in the conversion of the people from a love of sin to a love of righteousness. He believed strongly in the duty of rebuking and reproving sin. And he believed that all Christians have a responsibility in admonishing sinners. He wrote a paper entitled "The Admonition of the Sinner," in which he urges this upon ministers and Christians, that we need to rebuke gross sin. But we're too timid today. We don't do it, do we? Because of the reaction it would cause. But that very reaction would make the gospel an issue, even though it might bring suffering upon us. Well, I'll give you an example of how Grimshaw did this. On one occasion, he was in a shop which was full of people in Haworth, and he announced in the shop, he said, "Not far from me there is standing a man who slept with his neighbour's wife last night." You can imagine the traumatic effect of such a thing, and how Grimshaw became feared as a holy man of righteousness who would reprove sin in the name of the living God. In the summer of 1743, Grimshaw began to organize his converts into little groups, and he would visit and exhort them in their cottages and farmsteads throughout his parish and in the surrounding parishes eventually. At first, he was reluctant to cross parish boundaries, being an Anglican, but the spiritual needs of the people, neglected by the other clergymen in the area, persuaded him to do it. An insight into the great work which went on in Haworth is found in a letter written by a certain Joseph Williams, who was a clothier of Kidderminster, who frequently had to visit Haworth on business. And he writes of a visit he made in 1746, and this is what he says: "The work of conversion still goes on under his ministry. And many are now under deep conviction and are frequently coming to him for direction and comfort. One young man came whilst I was there, who together with his newly married wife are under such vast concern for their souls that they scarce know how to apply themselves to their outward calling till they have secured their immortal interest. Sometimes Grimshaw would preach as long as 2 hours with great power. Another visitor described how after hearing Grimshaw preached, she dined in the local inn crowded with about 100 strangers, yet she says that all the talk in the inn was, quote, such as was good to the use of edifying. They were all talking about spiritual things. The daily lives of the people, you won't be surprised to learn, were soon affected by the revival. Immorality and foul language declined. The drinking houses lost many of their customers, and Sunday sports were abandoned. Mrs. Gaskell is responsible for the story that Grimshaw used his horse whip to drive drinkers in the local pubs into church. The law of the land was that people had to attend the local church, whoever they were, and they were not really permitted to be in the pub at church times. But Mrs. Gaskell wrote 90 years after Grimshaw's death. So where did she get the story from? Well, it arose from her vivid imagination, in the main. But she was a novelist, and we must be big-hearted, surely. After all, most embroidered stories have some basis in fact. And it is true that it was Grimshaw's custom to check the churchyard for any malingerers. And the streets and the alehouses. If you've been to Haworth, you'll know there's about 3 public houses very near to the parish church. And he was out there to check up on any idlers. And he used to do this before or during the psalm that was sung before the sermon in the morning service. And those he found were firmly directed into the church with the authority common to the parson of those days. Now, 2 colourful incidents were probably the likely material for Mrs. Gaskell's story. The first is of an occasion when Grimshaw sent out 2 church wardens to check up on any parishioners idling their time away in the public houses nearby instead of attending worship. The time went by, the psalm had been sung, but the church wardens hadn't reappeared. And so Grimshaw himself left the pulpit, went out in search of the wardens whilst the congregation waited. And after a while, heavy footsteps were heard approaching from outside. And the porch door of the church flew open, and the stentorian tones of William Grimshaw's voice were heard. "What think you, what think you?" he boomed. "The church wardens who went out to detect others and prevent them from sinning, I have found in the inn drinking a pint of ale. For shame, for shame, for shame," he cried, as he remounted the steps of the pulpit and the church wardens sneaked in to their seats at the back of the church. Incidentally, it wasn't because of the ale. He wasn't a teetotaler, nor were people generally teetotalers in those days. They weren't. But it was the fact that they were there doing it when they should have been about their business in connection with the worship. The second incident, which did most, I think, to give rise to Mrs. Gaskell's story of the horsewhip, since it includes the use of a horsewhip, was an incident in far different circumstances. A group of the people who had been blessed through Grimshaw's ministry met together in a village outside Haworth for prayer, for regular prayer once a week. They had these prayer meetings. And it was reported to Grimshaw that a group of unruly youths had taken delight in jostling and sometimes assaulting some of these villagers as they gathered to attend the weekly prayer meeting. Now, one needs to remember there were no policemen in those days. People complain there are no policemen today, don't they? But there were no policemen in those days. And after this had happened two or three times, the leader of the meeting reported the incident to Grimshaw. And he asked to be informed if it happened again, and it did happen again. When the youths joined together to assault these worshippers, Grimshaw joined not the worshippers, he joined the youths, as though he were one of these louts. And there he was, of course he wasn't very old, he was just a young man, he joined the youths, and because it was dark, there were no lights, they didn't recognise the burly figure of the curate. As he urged them from the back of the group onwards. Gradually, he inched the gang of youths down the passageway, nearer and nearer to the lighted doorway of the cottage where the prayer meeting was due to be held. And then with one mighty heave, he ushered all the youths into the confines of the room and slammed the door behind him. And having done that, he pulled out from underneath his coat a horsewhip. And we are told that the youths, still blinking in the light, scarcely realizing what was happening, they saw Grimshaw with his horsewhip, and he, we are told, dealt round its utmost virtue on the astonished clowns until his vigorous arm was tired. And having suitably chastised them in that way, Grimshaw then fell on his knees and pleaded with great earnestness for their souls. They wouldn't have thought it incongruous that the vicar should have done that and then prayed for their souls. You might. We're living in soft days today. They were tough days. They wouldn't have thought it incongruous. They knew that they were getting the just penalty of their offences. But here, the man who chastised them here was praying for them from the depth of his heart. Many amazing conversions took place during the revival. One woman recounted how she and her husband, former Quakers, living 6 miles from Haworth, were brought into salvation. They were farming folk. Her husband went to Haworth out of curiosity, hearing about this preacher, and was converted. And he then tried to persuade his wife to go and hear Grimshaw. "I'll not go to hear that black devil," she retorted. Well, her husband pleaded with her, but failed to move her. So one day he decided on physical action. He forcibly dressed her in her Sunday best, took a rod, I said they were tough people, and drove her 6 miles to Haworth with his rod. "He drove me," she said, "as men drive a beast to market. I went calling and abusing Mr. Grimshaw all the way." But when she heard him preach, she was brought under great conviction of sin. And the following Sunday she returned to Haworth of her own accord, and Grimshaw noticed her distress, sought her out after the service and told her that on a certain day he would come and preach in their home, which he did. And she was soon converted. And that farmhouse became one of his regular preaching centres, and she was one of the first of a great number converted there under his preaching. Grimshaw preached regularly to congregations in Haworth numbering between 1,000 and 1,200 people, most of whom were drawn from the local community of 400 families. Of course, they had a lot of children in those days. He spoke plainly in what he called market language. Many of the people were uneducated and illiterate, so he endeavoured to use common speech, coloured with imagery from daily life. "If you perish," he would warn, "you will perish with the sound of the gospel in your lungs." Urging the young people to repent, he exclaimed, "Do not think you can dance with the devil all day and then feast with Christ at night." And pressing home the duty of all men to give God thanks for the blessing of food and drink, he pointedly commented, "Some of you are worse than the very swine, for the pigs will gruff over their victuals, but you say nothing." He could hold a congregation spellbound for 2 hours or more, with many moved to tears as the word of God came to them with convicting power. John Newton, who became his friend toward the end of Grimshaw's life, had this to say of him: "The solemnity of his manner, the energy with which he spoke, the spirit of love which beamed in his eyes and breathed through his addresses were convincing proofs that he did not trifle with his people." He was very vivid in his preaching. When preaching on the prodigal son, one listener recalled him crying out with great energy, "Yonder he comes, yonder he comes, all in rags, yonder he comes, rag, tag and bobtail." And all the congregation looked round to see the prodigal. So dramatic, you see, was his preaching. There's a story told in the autobiography of Richard Bursell, commonly known as Dickie Bursell, who became something of a preacher himself, of how he, at the age of 15, heard Grimshaw preach in Bingley on a December day with bitter winds whipping up newly fallen snow. Grimshaw had to brave a 5-mile trek along isolated moorland paths, possibly obliterated by snow, in order to reach Bingley. But everyone knew that if Grimshaw had promised to be there, he would arrive. And this 15-year-old lad describes the occasion. "When we got to the place, I trembled so much with the cold that I thought it would be impossible for me to bear it long. The place of worship was a barn, which had been fitted up for the purpose with deal seats and a pulpit. After waiting for a short time, a broad, sharp-looking man appeared, habited as a layman and buttoned up from the storm. Having quickly loosed his garments, in a moment he was in the pulpit, and giving out a hymn, the people sang like thunder. His voice in prayer seemed to me as it had been the voice of an angel. After prayer, he took a little Bible out of his pocket and read the following words for his text: Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill towards men. The Holy Ghost now shone upon my heart and discovered to me that both myself and all mankind were in a lost and perishing condition while in a state of nature. I wept and wished my parents had been there, knowing them to be in the same perishing state." He was converted, and I think his parents were converted too later. One writer has described Grimshaw as a Puritan on the war path. Well, like all true preachers sent by God, he had zeal for righteousness. And many colourful anecdotes have been told of his determination to deal with sin in its various blatant expressions. Well, there were annual horse races, or wakes, sort of holiday days, held on the moors above Haworth, which became events of much worldliness and dissipation. Grimshaw made representations to the organisers, but without success. So he announced that he would resort to man no more and instead seek the ear of his God. And this he did. And race week arrived with the usual large crowd intent on an orgy of drunkenness and riot. But the heavens opened, and for 3 days torrential rain fell on the moors, leading to a cancellation of the races, never again to be resumed. The young were in the habit of indulging in a variety of sports and less desirable occupations, sometimes on a Sunday afternoon on the moors above Haworth. On weekdays, Grimshaw often enjoyed a game of football with the young people himself, but he preached against using the Lord's Day for such activities, but his words availed little. So finally, he took to strolling across the moors himself to rebuke such delinquents. And bolting 5-bar gates was no problem for the new curate, as the young people soon discovered. For though they kept a sharp outlook for the approach of the parson, they were regularly spotted and reproved.
and often in public.
Sometimes Grimshaw would use disguise. Here's his dressing up coming in order to detect the true nature of things amongst his parishioners. There are a number of accounts, but one concerns a man and his wife whose professions of faith and holiness of life Grimshaw suspected, and as phony. He had heard that they were tight-fisted and unmerciful towards needy travellers. In those days, if a traveller came past your house and had need of a rest and accommodation, it was a practice always to give it. And Grimshaw heard about this couple who made great professions of holiness, so he borrowed a shabby weaver's jacket and cap. He dressed up looking like a poor beggar in need of urgent need of food and a night's lodging, and knocked on their door. And the man of the house came to the door, and Grimshaw asked for food and lodging, but the man was unmoved by his entreaties and was very harsh to him. At which point Grimshaw removed his disguise and delivered a serious lecture to him on covetousness and hard-heartedness. At first, Grimshaw was wary of the Methodists, and he didn't know much about them, such as Benjamin Ingham and John Nelson, but he soon discovered they were about the same business of gospel preaching as he was, and readily cooperated with them. He was much drawn to a certain preacher named William Darnie, a Scotsman, with whom he began to evangelize further afield. This man was a travelling preacher. It was not until 1747 that Grimshaw met John Wesley, but they were soon knit together in one heart for the work of the gospel. Well, John Wesley was Arminian, and William Darnie was a Calvinist, and he helped to enlighten Grimshaw, and Grimshaw really had Calvinistic views. But they could see that the essentials of the gospel were held by them all. He also came into contact with the amazing Countess of Huntingdon, and also with the greatest evangelist of them all, George Whitfield. There came into being in that area of Yorkshire what was called the Howarth Round. It was the old term for circuit. The early Methodists called it a round. And they established these various preaching stations, and they had a plan, and preachers would go from place to place. And Grimshaw, of course, visited a lot of these places that had been established. In 1747, Grimshaw had a deep spiritual experience which altered the course of his ministry. He wrote this: "My mind was deeply affected with strong impressions to preach the gospel abroad." That was beyond his immediate parish. The event I left to the Lord, fearing to be disobedient to what I trust was a heavenly call. He obeyed forthwith and set off on a preaching tour, which was to be typical of many such excursions throughout the following years: Todmorden, Manchester, Rossendale, Bacup, Rochdale, as well as many of the farms and hamlets too insignificant to be named on the way. He preached three or four times each day and was always back in Howarth for the Sunday services. What a man! Nothing now could hold Grimshaw back. He said, "I find the Lord's pleasure to be that I must launch out further. I will obey, for he daily convinces me more and more that he of what he has graciously done and will do for my soul. Oh, I can never do enough in gratitude and love to him for the least mite, if I may reverently so to speak, of what his blessings are to me." And so for the next 16 years of his life, he devoted his considerable physical and mental powers to spreading the gospel in many parts of the north of England. At times, he experienced severe persecution, and his life on occasions was imperiled. At Roughly, for example, in August 1748, he was very near to being killed by the mob. Charles Wesley was also beaten up. The pulpit of Haworth Church in those days was a three-decker with two texts inscribed upon it. One of these was 1 Corinthians 2:2, "For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified." And we have to say that that was absolutely central in all Grimshaw's preaching wherever he went. The glorious gospel of Jesus Christ radiated out from the unlikely centre of Haworth into Keighley, Bingley, Bradford, Halifax, Leeds, and most of the other towns and villages of the West Riding, and beyond to Otley, York, Pocklington, Hull, Sheffield, Glossop, Stockport, Manchester, Blackburn, Preston, Clitheroe, Kendal. All these places are mentioned as those he visited, and numerous other villages and towns in the north of England. He travelled on horseback and on foot, frequently preaching in parish churches, but more often in barns and farmsteads and cottages in the open air, urging men and women to repent and seek the mercy of God in Jesus Christ. And toward the close of his life, he declared, "At home and abroad, my work is the same, 'tis to preach Jesus and him crucified, to help through him poor sinners to God, grace and glory." His darling doctrine, as he called it, was the truth of the imputed righteousness of Jesus Christ to all who believe. "'Tis for the sake of the righteousness of Christ that all I have or hope for in time or eternity are mine," he wrote in a letter to a friend. Remission of sins, acceptance with God, all the promises, all the grace, and all the glory of God is mine forevermore. To whomsoever this righteousness is imputed through faith, all the blessings of the new covenant belong and are yea and amen. I can never say too much of it or for it. Well, in conclusion, and it's very brief, there's a lot that I've missed out, a lot more I could have included, some aspects of his life and ministry I have had to overlook. But a number of striking lessons, I think, arise from his life, of which I can mention just a few. The first is this: the importance of admonishing sinners and reproving gross sin in order to make the gospel an issue. We sometimes say, people won't listen to the gospel these days. Ah, but why not just start rebuking gross sin and see what will happen? At least it will make the gospel an issue. We have to be careful how we do it, of course. That's the first lesson. The second lesson is this: the need to maintain zeal in the work of God. Charles Wesley wrote, "Jesus, I fain would find thy zeal for God in me, thy yearning pity for mankind, thy burning charity." All so wonderfully exemplified in William Grimshaw. And the third lesson is this: the wonderful way in which God raises up men of outstanding preaching gifts in days of revival. We must pray that God may do it again. Sometimes I'm walking along a street and a lady comes along with a pram. And sometimes I dare to think in my mind, is that little lad in that pram going to become a mighty preacher? Because you will discover that in the first decade of the 18th century, from 1701 onwards, well, let's say for the 15 years, up to about 1715, an amazing array of great preachers were born. Well, whilst they were children, no one knew what they were going to be, except God. God had planned it. And thirdly, that's the third thing. And the fourth thing is this: the supreme importance of preaching. That comes out, doesn't it, in the spread of the gospel. There's less and less belief today in preaching. And I think that's because people don't know how to preach. And therefore, instead of talking about preaching, they talk about speaking. Someone will speak to us. But we need preachers. And therefore, we must pray that God
will raise up preachers, and we must believe in preaching and the preached word as the means that God supremely has used and will use for the conversion and the awakening of men and women to salvation.